This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're going to hear from the three candidates running for Orange County Sheriff. First, Orlando Police Chief John Mina, who's stepping down from that role. I asked Mina about the homicide rate in Orange County. According to stats from the Orange County Sheriff's Office, overall crime is down in the county, but homicides are up. Is that something that concerns you, thinking about what you might do if you're in this role?
Yeah, any homicide is one too many. And homicide is a crime of rage, a crime of passion, and because of that, something that's really hard to predict and prevent. So in other words, when we have a rash of burglaries or robberies, we can see a pattern developing in a certain area or for a certain type of car, if it's auto theft, where homicide, since it's many times a crime of passion or rage, it just happens because someone got into a fight or because there was an incident. It's hard to predict. So, but it is very concerning to us. Most of the homicides, both in Orange County and Silver Lando, are drug related. That's why both agencies do many operations. I know in the city of Orlando, we did one last month and, you know, netted the arrest of 29 drug dealers in an effort to try and prevent further violence related to drug activity.
You mentioned the School Safety Act, the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas bill that was passed by the Florida legislature. Orange County Sheriff's Office has been scrambling to cover the need for new school resource officers in the wake of that shooting and that law change. What's your approach going to be to school safety and making sure that, you know, everything's being done that can be done to prevent another school shooting?
So after the Parkland shooting, I was one of the very few chiefs that was called up to Tallahassee to give Governor Scott and his staff recommendations on the new school safety bill. One of my recommendations, along with other chiefs and sheriffs, was to have a school resource officer or deputy in every single school. In Orange County, we were already in good shape as compared to some other jurisdictions across the state. Some of my other colleagues didn't have any school resource officers. Here in Orange County, we already had, before the law, two in every high school and one in every middle school. But the gap was in the elementary school. So before the law, both Orlando and Orange County only had about one officer for every three or four elementary schools. So that's the gap that we need to fill. I know both our agencies, both OPD and Orange County, have gotten more money in their budget specifically for school resource officers. That happened this past October. Mm-hmm. When the budgets were passed. And so it's my intention to fill all those schools like I've done in the city of Orlando. Every school has a school resource officer. And I know it's a challenge. It's been a challenge for us. I know that's going to be a challenge when I'm sheriff at the Orange County Sheriff's Office. But I'm going to do my best to ensure there's a deputy in every single school.
How do you balance the need for security with the need for, you know, a certain amount of discretion when it comes to approaching certain situations involving school kids? Because, you know, there have been situations across the country where school resource officers, you know, their behavior has been called into question if they're tackling something that is more of a classroom discipline issue, and either a police officer or a deputy gets involved, and oftentimes things escalate and the kid is put in a position they shouldn't be put in. Like, how do you make sure that your deputies won't be behaving in that manner?
Well, that's all comes down to good training and good policies. And I know here in the city of Orlando and Orange County, you know, we ensure that our school resource officers go through a course and they talk about the specific things. You're there to enforce the law and keep kids safe. You're not there to enforce the school's policy, the administrative part of it. And as a matter of fact, all the chiefs and the sheriff meet with the chief of the Orange County Public Schools every single month. And that's one of the things that we talk about. I think one of the things that we've also done good in this area, and I will continue as the next sheriff, is to utilize the juvenile civil citations and mm-hmm. so that we're not putting our kids in handcuffs. The state of Florida says, and I believe their data, they say that the kids who are put in handcuffs and arrested and put in the system are more likely to reoffend. And they also say that the use of juvenile civil citations has really driven that down. So, mm-hmm. You know, probably 3 years ago, we'd already had the juvenile civil citation in progress, but we really stepped up our game and increased our juvenile civil citations by 232%, which caused our amount of juveniles being arrested to drop by almost 20%. So that's something we are all in on. That's something that I will continue as sheriff. And, you know, and let's face it, you know, myself, my fellow law enforcement officers, we didn't come into law enforcement to arrest kids. When I was in high school and there were fights or minor crimes, the police officers weren't called. It was all handled administratively. And I think that, you know, again, our officers and deputies ultimately are there to keep our kids safe and to prevent, you know, serious crimes from happening.
Does the notion of a Parkland-like situation, is that, would that be your worst fear as a sheriff, having to respond to that?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, our kids, they're supposed to be safe in our schools. And, you know, parents all across this county are dropping their kids off or putting their kids on the school bus now, hoping and praying that everything's going to be okay and they're going to be safe. So that, yeah, that's something that I think about all the time. That's something that we train for. And, you know, of course, in this area, you know, being you know, the chief that responded to the Pulse incident, something I'll never forget, and something that we're always looking at past incidences to see what we can do to prevent future incidents. So that's why we study all these past incidents and like the Parkland shooting, to see what we can do to get better, and also to help change legislation such as the new school safety bill.
Part of it is about response, though, and there has been a lot of criticism leveled at the sheriff's office and that responded to Parkland because of certain deputies who maybe didn't go in when people say there was an opportunity for them to go in and try and tackle the shooter. Like, how do you make sure that you would be doing everything you can to respond? Because the image of somebody just waiting in position while a shooting is going on, that is not something that the public wants to see, right? They want to see officers doing everything they can to go in and stop the shooter.
Right. So, you know, we dealt with that with the Pulse situation. And, you know, I think that the Justice Department, who hired the Police Foundation to do an independent after action report, so that, you know, our officers followed best practices at the time. And then I'm very sensitive to people trying to second guess law enforcement agencies. So I wasn't there in Parkland, but what I will tell you is that we have been doing active shooter training for many years. And in addition to that, specifically for our school resource officers, we have them go through additional training, and we make it very clear that they are there to protect those children, and they are there to save lives, even at risk to their own lives. And so what we've done is we're giving them the proper equipment to do that. It's additional body armor, Kevlar helmets, and long guns to help prevent and to help stop any type of active shooter.
John Mina, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Matt.
Up next, Daryl Shepherd, who says he understands what both sides of an arrest feels like. Daryl Shepherd is a candidate for Orange County Sheriff. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You say you want to change the system. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that we have a lot of distrust between law enforcement and the citizens that they serve. So we want to make it more transparent, bring some accountability. I think you have some issues with overcriminalization of our population and the citizens. For example, people with a joint end up, imprisoned for many, many years. And I think that's something that we can definitely look at and address.
Okay, so transparency and accountability, what would that actually mean in practice?
Well, accountability, again, making sure that we hold our officers to the same account as the laws that they enforce. And then transparency, you know, referring to such as body cameras, making sure the citizens can, you know, actually see what's going on in law enforcement versus relying on some person's account. Right now, I think that we have a fraternity type of system in law enforcement, where it's kind of like if anyone's went to college, they kind of understand the brotherhood, the blue curtain, as they've called it before. And when you have that kind of system and you don't have any checks and balances, and it's kind of top down, bottom-up kind of situation where the chief is going to have the final say in internal review or internal affairs investigations. I don't really see that there's any citizen involvement. Some of the other candidates want to actually remove the Citizens Review Board. I actually think that we need to enhance that. They've been on, you know, many forums stating that they feel like it's a bad idea because, you know, they've had issues with citizens saying that they're not doing their job. One particular situation refers to the Shellhorn situation, and I think that's the wrong direction. We have to bring citizens more involved in law enforcement as opposed to pushing them out. This is a public service or a public servant type of position as opposed to a dictatorship.
So speaking of your opponents, you're the one candidate in the race who doesn't have a law enforcement background. Do you think that puts you at a bit of a disadvantage?
I think that's a little inaccurate. I don't have as extensive of law enforcement background as the other two candidates. I have graduated the same police academy as every other law enforcement officer that would apply to be a law enforcement officer. I was a reserve officer in a small county in Gadsden.
What does that mean?
A reserve officer?
Mm-hmm.
Well, basically, that's an officer that is kind of part-time. You know, so when I was in college, back when I was 20 years old, I graduated the police academy. I did part-time work as a reserve officer, meaning, you know, if they needed you, or I would go in maybe on the weekends. But I don't have the extensive experience in law enforcement, such as a chief of police or 30 years as a background. I think that's one of the significant advantages that I do have, that I have also had a career in creating jobs as opposed to just being in law enforcement. I also understand both sides of the law, you know, in relations to, you know, citizens and being that real person and being for the people.
Let me just come back to your graduation from police college.
Police academy.
Police
so
academy.
Every person that wants to go mm-hmm. or become a police officer has to go through an FDLE certification. I did that. So I have a basic understanding at a minimum
right.
of what it takes to be a law enforcement officer.
Why did you decide not to pursue that as a career?
At that time, I was 20 years old. I was in college. You know, things wasn't as divisive as they are today. You know, I didn't see a lot of minorities getting, you know, shot unarmed, in a sense. I didn't see such a divide in law enforcement. And personally, you know, I wanted to pursue other things. I was very bright in college. I had a Bright Future Scholarship. I went to Florida State, FAMU as well. And I just wanted to be able to pursue other things before making a big decision as to committing to a career in mm-hmm. law enforcement.
As to your comment about you being the only candidate in the race to know what both sides of an arrest feel like, I wonder if you could just elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, you know, I have been arrested before. You know, I haven't been convicted of anything, but I do understand the process. I also understand the impact as far as consequences. You know, you look at this race and you look at other things, and that's the first thing people bring up, even though I haven't been convicted of anything. They still, in public opinion, like to make you convicted, and some people will try to discount the judicial process, discount the due process rights that we have and say, oh, well, there must have been a problem in the system. Everything was dismissed. Everything was dropped, but it was because he had a lot of money or he had. No, the system played out as it would in any other situation. Mm-hmm. So I understand that I would make sure, one, rearrest as a last resort. I think that's such a significant impact on someone's life that if you can find other means such as diversion, counseling, citation, and the forms of minor, you know, related such as drug arrest, marijuana, that's a good example of something that society is changing their views on.
I want to ask about some of the other things that are maybe top issues for somebody thinking about a law enforcement role in Orange County. One of the mm-hmm. things is the homicide rate in Orange County. What would you do to address that?
Well, I think we definitely need to address it, so to speak, in a literal fashion. Actually investigate, put some more effort into the way we investigate homicides. I think, you know, right now, at least from talking to people that have been victims of homicide,
You mean family members?
For example, there was one case, Travis Turner, You know, and I spoke to his family in regards to a situation where he was shot downtown at a nightclub, the Beecham nightclub, and they felt like they wasn't treated very properly. The investigation wasn't very transparent.
Was that a police investigation or a sheriff's office investigation?
It was a Orlando Police Department investigation. But again, you know, the sheriff's office can conduct any investigation and can assist in any role. So, you know, it happened within the county, and I think that the sheriff can, you know, take that investigation. And if there's, you know, some lagging in it, you know, they, and I feel like all law enforcement officers should be cooperating.
Darrell Shepard, I want to ask about school safety, because there has been a lot of focus on school safety and how to improve it, especially after the shooting in Parkland, Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School earlier this year.
Yes.
What would your role be as sheriff to promote school safety and keep these schools safe?
Well, I think initially, looking at all the school shootings that I've seen across the country, I think, you know, you have to enforce some of the same things that I went to school understanding. For example, your backpack was able to be checked. Your locker was able to be checked. You know, and right now we have a situation where, you know, people are, most of these shootings are student on student. They're not outsiders coming into the school, shooting up the schools. They're usually previous, you know, peers. So, you know, I feel like we should harden the perimeters in a sense. I am a proponent of metal detectors, not in a sense of saying that we're going to make our schools feel like jail. But, you know, look, we have a lot of technology today that we can really design things that fit within the environment.
Darrell Shepard, candidate for Orange County Sheriff, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And I spoke to Joe Lopez, a retired Florida Highway Patrol chief, who says investing more into technology is one way to help tackle the crime rate in Orange County. Well, Joe Lopez is a former Florida Highway Patrol chief. He's running for Orange County Sheriff. Welcome to Intersection.
Thank you, Ben. I appreciate it.
So tell me about your platform. What is it that sets you apart from the other candidates?
Well, there are several things that sets me apart, but to start with the platform, as look, I've been walking the community, Pine Hills, Orlo Vista, Apopka, Lake Nona, and everybody has the same concerns, and my platform appears to be resonating with the community, and that's to reduce violent crime, and the second part of that is community policing, and the third part is to have a robust recruitment and retention program. The violent crime, as you are aware, has increased, especially in the murders, you know, when you talk to everybody.
Well, the homicide rate has gone up in Orange County, but I believe the crime rate overall is down. Is that not correct?
In Orange County, but not in the city of Orlando.
Right.
In the city of Orlando, it's gone up. So for murder rates right now, it's 38. You got 38 homicides in the city of Orlando for 2018, 38, as compared to 2017 in the city of Orlando, you have 25.
Well, is that the responsibility of the sheriff, do you think, or is it more an Orlando City Police issue?
That's the leadership in the city of Orlando, the strategy they need to use. So 2018, so we're not even over. We still have three more months, okay, left in 2018, and we're at 38. So for the city of Miami, you have 38.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, for year-to-date, is the same amount that you have in the city of Orlando. In the city of Orlando, you have 280,000 people living in the city of Orlando. As compared to Miami, you have over 500,000.
My question is, like, what responsibility would that be for you as sheriff, and what could you do to help reduce that?
Well, my responsibility is to make sure that we're using the right technology. Okay, there's a lot of technology. Niven is a technology that's used. So when you have murders and you have weapons that are involved, so Niven is the newest technology. What's used is they match casings from weapons. Whenever you collect any weapons from whether it's a lost weapon or abandoned weapon or any weapon that's used in any type of case, you test fire that weapon that's in property, okay? Mm-hmm. So you just walk into an Orlando Police Department, you take all the weapons that are in there, you fire it, you take those casings and you take those projectiles and you submit it to the lab. So they have – it's almost like DNA. So you have a database of that weapon. They can determine if that weapon has ever been used, so forth. So that's one – when I talk about evidence-led policing, so that's one way of technology. We got to leverage technology of doing it. And then you got to find out some of these causes, these root causes of murders, whether it's drug related, if it's domestic violence related.
So you're saying you want to see more of an emphasis on technology. What about staffing? Is the Orange County Sheriff's Office staffed up enough?
It's a good, very good point. This county is growing. All right, the population is increasing. It's a great county to live in. Everybody's moving here. It's 1,000 people moving to the state of Florida every day. A large chunk of that is moving to Orlando, Orange County, and they're coming from New York, they're coming from Puerto Rico, they're coming from Miami, they're coming from Venezuela. So we haven't the county government has not kept up with that growth.
As far as policing and law enforcement?
Right, because what happens is let's take an example, East Orlando.
Mm-hmm.
East Orlando is a very big sector when it comes to Orange County Sheriff's Office, and a lot of people are moving there, and the population is growing out east. So when they start building roads and they start planning buildings and roads and everything, the sheriff's office needs to have a seat at the table. We need to be there because it takes, you know, a year to train.
Let me ask about one specific aspect of deputies and staffing, and that is school security or school safety, because after the shooting in Parkland, there's now a need for making sure that schools have adequate sort of law enforcement presence within them. What would you do to make sure that schools in Orange County have that law enforcement presence?
Well, I take this situation very personally. My wife works in the school system, and my kids went to the school system, elementary, middle school, and high school. Now they are at UCF. So for so many years, when I left the house to go to work in uniform, you know, they would hug me and kiss me and you know, and tell me, hey, be safe in return. Well, that role has changed now. Now they're walking out the door, and now they're going to the schools, and they're going to work. So I'm petrified like every other father should be. So there is no single solution to this. So it's a multifaceted approach. A, yes, more law enforcement. That's number one. Number two, you got to work with the school board, okay? That responsibility does not fall under the sheriff's mission, core mission. But we work with the school to make sure that they're properly doing the security assessments, you know, how to fortify or harden the schools. Now, what do I mean by that? Single point access. So if a school has 15 entries, well, let's break it down to maybe half, okay? And they're only going to be used for exits. And to come into the school, you'll have a single point access, which is controlled either by a person manning those doors and also having some type of an access card or a central security location, but it has to be controlled. Hmm. My experience as a United States Marine on embassy duty, and also I am I lead the security team at Disney, the entrance is the vulnerable part. If you can harden and prevent anybody coming to the entrance, then the foundation of it will be secure.
Joe Lopez, if you were elected sheriff of Orange County, you would be the first Hispanic sheriff in this county, right?
Yes, the first one running for a sheriff and then the first one to be elected in Orange County, history of Orange County.
What does that mean to you? Do you reflect on that as you kind of head into the final weeks of this campaign?
You know, I didn't think much about it when I first did it. Being so diverse, coming from diversity. However, you're reminded as you're on the campaign trail when others take notice of that. It's very proud because, you know, from my background and my upbringing, I am the son of two Cuban immigrants who came to this country with nothing on their backs. You know, I was almost born in Cuba. My mom came here while she was pregnant with me. And she worked three jobs raising me and my sister in the Bronx.
Hmm.
You know, so, you know, we grew up poor. And I was the first one to get a college education in my family. And you know, joining the highway patrol, I was one of two Hispanics to reach the rank of major and above in the Florida Highway Patrol, 32nd Hispanic. So I look back, I'm proud. It makes me work harder, you know, because the competition is fierce, as you can see. So I probably look at it that way more than anything else, that it gives me purpose and gives me drive. But I will be the sheriff for everybody. I will be the people sheriff, the sheriff of diversity, coming from the Bronx, coming from Miami and Orlando. There's a lot of diversity here. You got people moving from all parts of the area. So That's what I'm most proud of. And I set an example for my children so that way they can work hard too.
Joe Lopez, candidate for Orange County Sheriff, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Matt. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
And find more information about the candidates on our website, wmfe.org/intersection. Up next on Intersection, from the classroom to space, inspiring the next generation of astronauts, engineers, and scientists to power their missions to take astronauts to the moon and beyond. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Lynn Dotson was a classroom teacher until a trip to space camp changed her life. Now Dotson's a NASA education specialist, and this Friday she'll be leading a workshop at Paramore Kids Zone in Orlando, teaching kids about the challenges of space travel. From the education desk this week, Dotson talked to Intersection about her role as an ambassador for space education.
This will be the second time I've actually been there. The first time we went with an entire group of NASA educators, and we had like a station activity where the kids would walk around and do different things at the stations. But this year, we are going to do a little smaller scale just because of funding. But what I will do is just be doing a living in space presentation. So I'm not an astronaut, but I work with many astronauts, and I get a chance to talk a little bit about what it's like to live in space, what NASA's up to, how do we get to space, and kind of get the kids excited about what NASA's has on the horizon. Since it's big in the news, we're going back to the moon now, and after that, we will eventually make it to Mars, so we're developing a new rocket for that. And I will have all kinds of pictures and visuals and some videos to show of how we get to space and the challenges of that. And then once we're in space, how we live and sleep and eat. And the big question the students have about the astronauts is, you know, how do they go to the bathroom in space? How do they go on an EVA? So there's so many questions students have. And this group of particular students, I don't know if they've been exposed as much to science and the space and coming to Kennedy Space Center. So we try to bring it to them.
Do you see your role a little bit, Lynn, as finding the kids who might be interested in setting out on a STEM career down the track and maybe being the scientists or astronauts who are part of the space program in the future?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's my job description, is to get these kids, first of all, expose them to stuff that they might never be exposed to. Let them know that it is a possibility, that as long as, you know, they're driven and really try hard in school and are determined, they can get a job here, even being an engineer or being someone that works here at the facility. It's just like a mini city here at Kennedy Space Center. So We have jobs for everybody. A lot of the kids will want to be an astronaut, but there's other really cool STEM fields out here. So part of my job is to inspire our future generation to go into the STEM field.
You mentioned some of the questions that are top of mind for kids when they're learning about space or trying to figure out what it might take to get to the moon and beyond and live in space. You know, some of the obvious ones are, as you said, how do you go to the bathroom in space? What are some of the surprising questions that you've fielded from kids? I wonder if there are some things that really make you think about what it actually means to be an astronaut and some things you might not expect from a group of young aspiring scientists or kids who are thinking about setting out in that STEM path.
Some of the more interesting questions, they always want to know what's, you know, if they are in the International Space Station, if these astronauts get sick, what's the protocol? How do they get back? How do they deal with that? So that's one of those interesting questions that, you know, they are quarantined before they go into space. So we kind of explain that and how we're trying not to expose them to any germs for a certain amount of time before they go into space. Some other ones, they have these ideas on how, when we go into space, they understand space is not a very conducive environment to live in. And so, you know, they actually can come up with some ideas as to the solution, because I will present that to them and say, how will we get further than the moon? Even if we're outside of Earth's atmosphere, what are some things that could possibly harm an astronaut? and what are the challenges of the deep space travel? And they'll ask a lot of questions about that and have ideas and solutions. So it's kind of neat to hear some of the things they have. A lot of it they probably have seen on movies, sci-fi. Mm-hmm. But then we talk about real versus, you know, science fiction, and they always ask about The Martian, the movie The Martian. Talk a little bit about that, and, you know, any kind of science fiction. If you can tie it to the books or tie it to movies, they just get really, really excited about it.
You mentioned earlier, Lynn Dotson, that part of the reason you're sort of working with a slightly smaller program this time around is that there's less funding. Is that something you're concerned about, or are you looking for more funding so you can keep doing more of these outreach programs and get kids involved in STEM?
Absolutely. There's just to give you a little background on my current situation, when I was first hired as a NASA educator, I was a certified teacher in the classroom. They sent me to space camp, and then they hired me on here, and we had a fairly large education team here. Well, since I started funding with education, and I think it's not just NASA, it's all around. Unfortunately, education is one of the first things to get cut or dropped when you're looking at programs and trying to fund things, which is the worst, in my opinion, it would be the worst place to cut funding, because we are trying to inspire those students to eventually get into the STEM field. So we need that money. But what's great about my partnership now, that we were funded by NASA Education, and then now we are still supported by NASA Education, but our funding comes from the Astronauts Memorial Foundation. And so we're a living memorial to honor the astronauts that we have lost, 24 astronauts either trying to get to space or coming back from space or training for space. So that's what I love to explain to people, is that they picked us up. Once that education money got cut, Astronaut Memorial wanted us to, I mean, they understood how important our roles were and what we were doing to get kids exposed to space and NASA, and so they wanted to fund us. You know, we are nonprofit, but we don't charge for any program. The kids can come here or we can go to schools, and it's a great experience.
I didn't realize that space camp was something that adults could do too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There was something, a program called the Honeywell program, where they would send educators to camp. It's a week-long program in Huntsville, Alabama. And, yeah, they expose you to all the astronaut training. You actually do a simulation at the end where you're actually going into space. And I was the commander. Somehow they picked me as a commander. I have no idea why. I had a hard time landing the shuttle. I mean, it was just a simulation, but it really did expose me to, man, in my backyard, I'm from Melbourne, and I have this really great facility that's in my backyard. I can step outside and see a rocket launch anytime I want, and I just had to work here and spread the word about that.
Well, Lynn Dotson, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me.
Lynn Dotson is a NASA education specialist. She's leading a workshop about space exploration at Paramore Kids Zone in Orlando this Friday. Still to come, when in doubt, draw nudity, and other lessons from two of Florida's editorial cartoonists. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Editorial cartoonist Andy Marlett and Dana Summers may draw from opposite ends of the political spectrum, but they both cherish the value of the cartoon, whether skewering the mendacity of political figures or illustrating the humanity in a community's response to tragedy. The First Amendment Foundation is bringing Marlett and Summers to the stage in Orlando this Wednesday for a conversation, Political Cartoons in the Time of Trump. I caught up with the two cartoonists ahead of that appearance. Well, Andy Marlett is a columnist and cartoonist for the Pensacola News Journal. Thank you for joining us, Andy.
Thank you for having me.
And Dana Summers is an editorial cartoonist. He also pens two syndicated comic strips. Dana, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Dana, I want to start with you. Until 2012, you were the Orlando Sentinel editorial cartoonist. Since then, you've been working for the Tribune agency. Your cartoons kind of get printed everywhere in the country and beyond. What's the last little while since you left the Sentinel been like for you as a cartoonist?
Quite a change, going from having to sit in the newspaper all day, having an office, and most of all having an editor, mm-hmm. which I don't have now. So the upside is that that I don't have to really answer to anyone as far as political bent or taste, although you kind of police yourself on that sort of thing. And it's freer. And I make my own hours. I work when I want to. As long as the deadlines are met, I don't have a problem. The downside is it's very isolating. I don't see too many people during the day, so go a little stir crazy sometimes.
So back when you were working at the Sentinel, was it like kind of essentially being a reporter? You would bat up a bunch of ideas in the morning, kind of see if they worked. Your editor would work with you. You would maybe submit some stuff, and they'd say, no, that's not good, or fix this here, or we can't run that.
Absolutely. That's exactly how it was. Mm-hmm. I would go in, and I'm not sure how Andy works, but I would always go in early because we would have an editorial board meeting at, I think it was 9 o'clock, and I was expected to have a few ideas to run by the editor. And sometimes, there might be one or two that he liked, sometimes, or she, and sometimes there would be none that, mm-hmm. that they would like. And so you'd have to go back, as they say, go back to the drawing board and see what you can come up with. So
literally, right?
Yeah, and I think my deadline at the time was something like, I had all day to do it.
Well, Andy, let me bring you into this conversation. You are the Pensacola News Journal cartoonist. So what does your day look like? Is it kind of similar to what Dana was describing, his kind of workday routine back when he worked at the Sentinel?
You know, it's funny. I mean, nowadays, whatever people are gossiping about on Facebook and Twitter, for better or worse, does, I think, kind of drive what you end up drawing about. You know, you throw the grenade of a political cartoon out there into the debate, and, you know, it can jump right in there with the best of them. Not quite have the impact of a Trump tweet, but you know, we all got something to aspire to, so.
Sure. So do you kind of have several ideas in the hopper per day? Like, do you have to have a bunch of ideas because you know that some of them just might not get past the editor in the morning?
Yeah, well, I don't know how Dana is, but, you know, being somewhat immature mentally, I mean, my first idea always goes to nudity. And, you know, if partial nudity sometimes gets across, but, you know, usually editors frown on full nudity in cartoons. So then you got to kind of up the game a little bit and actually try to incorporate some thoughtful ideas. It is the hope. That's the goal.
One of your favorite subjects to draw cartoons of is Governor Rick Scott. And speaking of nudity, one of the cartoons I'm thinking of is you've called it the Moonshine State, and it's a picture of Governor Scott mooning some people out the window of, I guess, his office. Describe the process that went into making that cartoon.
Well, I think it was probably a series of news stories at that point. But, you know, that one was actually one inspired by my uncle, Doug Marlette, who was the great Pulitzer-winning political cartoonist who I sort of got in this business from. And when he was working for the Charlotte Observer, he actually did a similar cartoon to Jesse Helms, mooning the state of North Carolina, and with the caption, "Carolina Moon Keeps Shining." And so I think Governor Scott sort of, his policies towards openness and public records and science, I think that gesture sort of summed it up.
Have you met the governor? Have you sort of sat down and had a conversation with him?
I've met him at a couple editorial board meetings here over the years. And, you know, some public officials are actually big fans of the cartoons, even if they're the targets of them. But, you know, Governor Scott hasn't asked for an autograph cartoon yet.
Let me switch back to you then, Dana Summers, for a moment. You also have some kind of frequent appearances in your cartoons. Some of the people you like to draw, or they appear frequently, the Clintons. You still are able to find a lot of material on that. Has the way you draw them or the approach to some of the kind of editorial content changed over the decades?
Well, they won't go away, so that's why I'm drawing them. I'm terrible with caricatures, in my opinion. And so I could never really get Hillary down very well. So when I'm doing a Hillary cartoon, I always sort of cringe when I look at the finished product because it's just not something that I think is well drawn. But, you know, Hillary's out there. And recently there was an interview where they talked about Bill. So into doing the tour, And I think there's a Broadway show, I think, coming up involving Hillary. So they're out there, and if they're out there, they're fair game, I guess, is how I think about it.
The never-ending gift to cartoonists, the Clintons.
I don't get up in the morning thinking, what can I draw that's going to hit the Clintons? I just kind of look around, see what's out there, and try to draw what I think people are seeing.
The role of the cartoonist, though, has changed quite a bit. I mean, as you know, Dana can attest to, the Sentinel no longer has an editorial cartoonist in-house. I'm sure a lot of newspapers are the same. They rely on syndicated material, or sometimes they just don't run a cartoon at all. Do you feel like there is still a place for a cartoonist, you know, in general terms, in a newspaper? Should every newspaper have an editorial cartoonist, do you think?
I absolutely do. You know, nobody challenges the status quo like a cartoonist, and you know, and that works. That's not just, you know, with the big national figures and the national stuff. I mean, cartoons can really hit home and be effective when you're drawing pictures about the mayor or the sheriffs, and I mean, it's powerful stuff, and really kind of lights fires of conversation in your neighborhoods and communities. So,
Dana, what do you think? I mean, do you think that in this era, when you know Twitter and social media have become so prominent in the news cycle, in some ways, is there still the same kind of role for a cartoonist, or is news sometimes caricature in and of itself? Like, what can you do to enhance a story that sometimes is larger than life?
Yeah, first of all, I'd have to agree with Andy. Newspapers really benefit from having a cartoonist, especially, as he pointed out, the local aspect. You can really, newspapers can really have an impact with a local cartoon. A local cartoonist drawing about local issues is really a big deal. But it's changed. And now you've got Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all of that. You can get away with putting stuff up there that I could, if I wanted to, knowing that my syndicate would never take it. Andy, you could use all your nudity cartoons on those platforms if you wanted to. It's changing so fast that being an old guy here and being around and watching all the changes, my head's still reeling a little bit about social media and how to handle it as far as cartoons go. Luckily, I still have some lists of newspapers who will use it. And you're right, newspapers, I think there's only 40. I saw a figure the other day that there's only 45 working full-time cartoonists at newspapers now. It used to be over 200,
wow.
280 or something like that. So it's really dropped off, and I think newspapers are suffering for it. Yeah, they get to use syndicated stuff, but as I said before, they really miss out on the local angle.
I want to ask about Hurricane Michael. It's different from just a straight-ahead political story because there's a real human element that you want to capture. Andy, do you feel like, because you depict Governor Scott, you've sort of developed this image of Governor Scott, that is, it must be pretty easy for you to draw that particular image right now. But were you tempted to try and humanize the governor and step aside from the politics there as well, or did that not cross your mind?
It's tempting. I mean, I don't think I've really done any picking on the governor in this, because I mean, sometimes even cartoonists have to admit when our elected officials are out there and, you know, trying to do what's right for the folks who are suffering out here. Truces are temporarily declared in times of need.
Dana Summers, what was your approach to the cartoon? You've got an image in particular, which is a couple of journalists talking to somebody in the midst of this pile of rubble. Just describe that for our listeners and how you came up with the idea and the finished product.
Well, I just wanted to get across the idea that, you know, you could lose everything you own, but as long as you have your family, you're still hanging in there. I mean, that cartoon wasn't rocket science by any means, but I've taken that approach on different occasions, and that was really all there was to it. Yeah, you can lose all your possessions, but I think the image had a guy hugging his bunch of family members in there.
And speaking of rocket science and other calamitous events, I mean, there's a cartoon I'm thinking of after the Challenger disaster. It's an image of the space shuttle. There's a tear coming down. There's a bunch of doves being released from the cargo bay. It must be quite tricky to change gears and say, I'm not going to be funny now. I'm going to try and treat this seriously. How do you do that?
Yeah, that was a tough one because the shuttle, I think the shuttle blew up somewhere around 11, 1130, something like that. We were putting out a special edition at 2 o'clock. So we had, well, it was, I think the special edition was at 3 o'clock, but we had to have our ideas by 2 o'clock. So we only had a couple of hours to come up with something. And this is the kind of thing that, you know, you just think, what in the world am I going to do with this? So I had a couple of ideas, and, you know, when in doubt, use a tear, you know. And, so I had two different rough sketches, and we decided to just combine them. And when we put that out, I just thought, this is one of the worst things I ever did in my life, but here it is, you know, kind of on a deadline, and this is what you get. And people just seemed to really like it, and I had a great reaction, and they printed up 1,500 or so copies and gave them out to readers, and we went to the Space Center, and it was a big deal. So it goes to show you never know how something's going to hit the public, and that one was a surprise to me because I just didn't think it was that great of a cartoon, but there you go.
And you know, Matthew, I think what Dana accomplished there is part of why cartoonists are so valuable to newspapers. You know, I mean, it's not all about the politics. It's you know, you're working with emotion here, and you're capturing things that just isn't captured in any other form. And you know, I found over the years that readers really, really connect to that and in a sort of emotional and personal way. And and you know, even the ones that hate you connect to it in a personal way. But it's this kind of really special relationship that I don't know that any other journalist sort of connects in the same way to our readers that cartoonists do.
Andy Marlett, is this a good time to be a political cartoonist? The fact that, you know, cartoonists are kind of a shrinking band of people across the country, notwithstanding. Is this a good era politically to be out there and putting your artwork in the public eye?
Oh, that's a loaded question. I mean, I think every day I should have gone to law school. But, you know, I mean, you don't make a lot of money, but there's plenty of material these days. The biggest worry is real life becoming too much like a cartoon, you know, to the point where when that happens, how do you make funny pictures about it when, you know, reality is a funny picture?
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Dana? Is that your approach as well?
Yeah, how do you exaggerate something that's already exaggerated to the point where, you know, whatever you do is not going to top what's out there already? Yeah, it's crazy. And right now, you know, it's hard to make money as a political cartoonist. People just starting out who don't have a newspaper, how do they get paid? I mean, unless you're with a syndicate that sells to newspapers, you know, it's kind of like, you know, when the musicians, the rock musicians, everything, with iTunes and everything came in, they lost a lot of money because it's a different system now. And that's the way it is with editorial cartoons now. And probably, I would say, with comic strips, too. I mean, you can go online to a number of different sites and get whatever comic strip you want for the day. You don't have to buy a newspaper to do it. So it's all in flux right now, and it's a little discouraging a little bit, I guess.
Right. Well, Dana Summers and Andy Marlett will be talking at a forum with the First Amendment Foundation on October 24th. Moderated by Scott Maxwell from the Orlando Sentinel. Dana Summers, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Andy Marlett, thank you as well.
Thanks, Matthew. It's good to talk to y'all.
And you can find more information about the event, Political Cartoons in the Time of Trump, at our website, wmfe.org/intersection. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Education reporting on 90.7 News is supported by Helios Education Foundation. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Shania Richburg. WMFE's Fall Silent Drive is underway. We're looking to raise the money we need to keep programs like Intersection on the air. Become a sustaining member today and we'll send you a thank you gift like some custom WMFE socks. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. And thanks for listening.